Well, I think I have an unbelievably independent record of really unprecedented recoveries for the state as well as for people of the state of Illinois. So over the time that I've served as the Attorney General in Illinois, I've brought in over $10 billion in revenue to the state, and that does not even include over $2.8 billion for homeowners and communities and pension systems due to mortgage fraud and the numerous investigations and lawsuits that I've brought to hold the entities responsible for that. In addition to over $2 billion in savings and refunds for utility customers. And so all told, if you do all the math, it's been over $15 billion for the state as well as people of the state of Illinois since I served as your Attorney General. And I think it's come at an incredibly critical time. At no time during my lifetime have we ever experienced such an economic crisis and then downturn in terms of revenues to the state. And so that's really been, I would say, one of the number one priorities, making sure that the state, as well as the people of the state, are financially secure. In addition to that, I've done an enormous amount of important work when it comes to making sure that we're really rebuilding trust with people in the state. And so as the Attorney General, in the aftermath of Rod Blagojevich's tenure, went to the Illinois Reform Commission, asked for increased powers, in particular to deal with government accountability and fraud in government, as well as making sure that we actually established a Public Access Counselor's Bureau to make sure that when somebody was denied information under Freedom of Information Act or there was a violation of the Open Meetings Act, that there would be a body that could look over that, review it, and make a determination about what should have happened to make sure that people are getting the information that they deserve and that we really change the culture of secrecy that had been in place. But also through the institution of a system of inspectors general, as well as expanding their powers to be able to do investigations, has really been critical. And in addition to that, I would point to a lot of the work that I've done on behalf of some of the most vulnerable people in our state. Safeguarding children and protecting seniors has been absolutely critical because, unfortunately, those people in our society are far too often victims of crimes, whether they be terrible crimes of sexual assault or they be situations where, in particular with seniors, they're really the targets of some of the worst of the consumer fraud scams. And so I've done an enormous amount of good and independent work on behalf of people and our state, and I look forward to doing more, in particular bringing in more money for our pension systems. And the last year alone, I've already had three settlements worth $488 million, most of that money going to recoup losses that our pension system suffered from investments in really faulty mortgage-backed securities. As well as making sure that we're also looking into the problems with student loan debt, leading a multi-state investigation into Sallie Mae, which is the largest of the student loan servicers, and doing a lot of work at the forefront of going after and determining why we're suffering so many data breaches and better protecting people from identity theft. So far, my identity theft unit has helped over 35,000 people in Illinois recover and have removed from their credit over $26 million in fraudulent charges. So as you can hear, there's a tremendous amount of work that I'm able to do as your Attorney General, and I look forward to continuing to do it.
And yet, of course, new proposals always, including one that would allow cameras in nursing homes to monitor how the elderly are treated. That is a growing trend, it seems. For example, a law that would require body cameras on police and in squad cars has been proposed. There are red light cameras. Could you speak to this increase of surveillance of people as they go about their everyday lives? As an attorney, does that propose, it would seem, a lot of issues in terms of what would be private information potentially becoming public?
The proposal to look at how we can better protect people when they're in nursing homes comes from the work that I've done over the years dealing with this very issue in nursing homes. And so a number of years ago, we had to go in and shut down a nursing home because there were criminals living in that nursing home who were abusing other older people in the nursing home. They were setting fires in the nursing home. The police, the fire department were being called to the nursing home oftentimes more than once a week. Clearly a situation that was not safe, not appropriate for anybody who was living or working there. In the aftermath of that, I went to the legislature and said, listen, we need to change the law to make sure that when somebody with a criminal background is going into a nursing home, we identify them, we know that, we put in place security procedures so that that person, you know, won't be roomed with another vulnerable adult, and so that way they can't cause any problems for anybody, but they can still receive the care they need. In the aftermath of that, I initiated something called Operation Guardian, where we were going into nursing homes and we were making sure that everybody there, they had done the background check and everybody knew what was going on. And we found so many people who had active arrest warrants out. It was really a shocking situation. And so really one of the next steps I think that is logical is to make sure that to the extent that there is inexpensive, widely used technology available to monitor people when they're in a nursing home, it does two things. One, it gives peace of mind to the family members who may not be able, on as frequent of a basis as they want, to go in and see how their loved ones are doing, to literally just be able to check in. You know, is my mom awake? Is my mom asleep? Is my mom eating? Is she not eating? Just to be able to see. And then, God forbid, in the circumstance where something does happen, you actually have, or there's an allegation that something happens, you actually have the ability to review and to see. And so in my mind, this is kind of win-win-win. It's win for the resident who will have this option, who knows that somebody's watching over. It's win for the family member who gets peace of mind. And really, it's win for the nursing home, because then they've got some sort of a record. And if they do have an employee who's not treating people properly, then they can use that to say, all right, you shouldn't be employed with us anymore, and they kind of cut off that liability that they're otherwise going to have to contend with. In terms of the privacy issues that you bring about, because this really is kind of the number one response that I get back from nursing home owners and operators, there's no HIPAA violation, there's no privacy issue if the person consenting to it is the actual resident. And so under those circumstances, we already have four states that allow cameras in nursing homes, and it has not been a problem. In fact, what I have heard is that it actually has been a help. So you won't have privacy issues. Another option is, listen, if you don't want a camera, you can still do an audio recording. So there are ways to handle, you know, some of those situations. But this is absolutely a debate that needs to be had, in large part because of what you just talked about. You know, in the aftermath of 9/11, I think cameras are virtually everywhere. You really don't walk down a street, and you certainly don't walk into a building where you're not probably, you know, somehow being watched and possibly being taped. And so this is simply a way to use that inexpensive technology to better protect people in nursing homes who can be very vulnerable and not have somebody watching over them. I would actually argue that it doesn't make any sense. You know, somebody goes to put their dog in a kennel, and they can sit at their desk during the day and they can watch their dog, but yet they're not allowed to watch after their mother or their father, their grandmother or their grandfather. I just don't think that makes any sense. So I think it's a conversation and a debate that we need to have, and I can guarantee you at some point it's going to be the law in Illinois and across the rest of the country.
You had mentioned your work regarding corruption and ethics. That is something that your opponent, Republican Paul Schimpf, has said the office has not done enough with, saying that there is, on one hand, a potential conflict of interest regarding the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative, given that you were on the board overseeing it, the Violence Prevention Authority board. So I guess another twofold question there. Number one, did you have any responsibility as co-chair there to have noticed or seen any of the issues with NRI? And number two, is it the Attorney General's role to be more involved in issues such as the NRI or patronage at the Department of Transportation?
So the Attorney General's priorities always have to be focused on, you know, what's the law, what's the authority that the office is given. And in the Constitution, it says that the Attorney General shall serve as the legal officer of the state. And really what that means is that your Attorney General in Illinois serves primarily as the state's civil lawyer. And at any given time, we're probably defending approximately 30,000 civil cases. I run the fourth largest law firm in the state. I'd guess 85% of the work that we do is on the civil side. For a very long time, and the law provides for this, it is the state's attorneys that have always had primary responsibility for investigating, indicting, and prosecuting people who violate our criminal laws. Now, nonetheless, you know, I have never shirked my responsibilities and, you know, and never not used the full authority of our office to go after corruption, whether it be private sector or public sector corruption. So you'll recall, early in one of my terms, we went after the Emerald Casino license to have that revoked, initiated an investigation along with State's Attorney, then Cook County State's Attorney Dick Devine, into Rod Blagojevich, and continued that until Pat Fitzgerald, who was then the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, asked us to halt our investigation and turn that over to his office, which we did. But also, you can look a long list of county-level officials who, because a state's attorney believed that they had a conflict, I ended up out of our office prosecuting, whether it was a Democratic sitting state representative or the Democratic state's attorney in Rock Island County. Most recently, just the other last month, in fact, it was the sitting Democratic county sheriff in Rock Island County, in addition to numerous other county officials. I've also done an enormous amount of work when it comes to going after and making sure, as I talked about, that we're changing what had really been almost like this default, you know, in our state, you know, everything, you know, secrecy, and letting the sunshine in. Spearheaded a rewrite of the Freedom of Information Act, spearheaded the legislation that put in place the Public Access Counselor as a statutory position that had binding opinion authority to make sure that those laws are being followed and the public is receiving the information that it should. So I would argue that, you know, I've aggressively enforced the civil laws that our office is authorized to enforce, as well as using all of the other tools and even creating new tools to fight corruption and to increase government accountability. So I think I've got a very strong record on that front. In terms of the other issue that you brought up, there's no conflict at all. So if you look at the Auditor General's report on the NRI program, you'll see that the governor's administration had conceived of it. It was already actually being implemented by the time it was even brought to the IVPA board. In terms of my responsibility to provide direction and advice to members of state government, I was requested and have engaged in conversations with members of the legislature on the Legislative Audit Commission about how to proceed on questions that they had. And so I have fulfilled my role in that regard, and I do so every day, regardless of party, regardless if people are Democrats or Republicans, and have been publicly thanked for the work that we've done on that front.
Your opponent has also made statements saying that if he believes a law passed by the General Assembly and signed by the governor is unconstitutional, he would not defend it. What is your view of the Attorney General's responsibilities? He names as an example that it could be done the way that your office handled questions about same-sex marriage and how county clerks could go about issuing licenses to same-sex couples.
So the issue of the constitutionality of a ban on same-sex marriage in Illinois, when those lawsuits got filed, the state was never filed, or was never sued, I should say. And so there was never a situation where I wasn't defending the constitutionality of a law in Illinois. But in those circumstances, there is a Supreme Court rule that gives the Attorney General the authority and the opportunity to weigh in on their view of the law when somebody else has challenged it, even if they're not a party to the case. In the circumstance of the pension law and in general, the analysis that I do is the following. You always look at the facts that are presented, and you look at the law that's being challenged, and you look at the history of the cases that are out there that are relevant to make a determination as to not just the constitutionality, if that's what's being challenged, but also to make a determination if you can make a credible, colorable argument to the court. Because as the Attorney General, you are constitutionally and statutorily charged with defending the laws of the state of Illinois. And I am not in a position, I believe, to substitute my personal judgment on whether I like or dislike a law with actually following the law. And so when it comes to the pension reform litigation, done a very thorough analysis of that, and am defending that law because there are very credible arguments to be made about why what the legislature did in response to an unprecedented deficit and unfunded liability in our pension systems, why what they did is a reasonable and necessary response to contending with that.
Speaking of the pension lawsuit, if a trial court does declare it unconstitutional, are you going to appeal to the state Supreme Court?
Oh, I would presume that the case will ultimately make its way to the Supreme Court, regardless of how it gets ruled on in the circuit court. But, you know, we're obviously going to have to see, you know, what the rulings are, and, you know, until we have a ruling, we really won't, you know, can't be prematurely making strategy decisions.
Your office has also been involved with a case regarding the governor's race, but going back to the primary, and Treasurer Dan Rutherford facing allegations of sexual harassment from one of his former employees. Your office has said that the argument was not sufficiently severe or pervasive and that the charges of racketeering were baseless. Just do you believe that what should happen with that case, and how did that affect the governor's race? Was that, does it appear as if this was purely political?
Amanda, I'm not going to comment on cases that are currently going through the system at this point. You can read our briefs, and you're always welcome to quote what's in those briefs.
Let's move on then to FOIA. I know you talked about that in the beginning of our conversation and the creation of the Public Access Counselor. I believe that there was talk of, always talk, I guess, of rewrites of FOIA after the major rewrite, any tweaks that need to be made to it. How is that law working? Are there any changes? And one of the ideas that I've heard proposed is exempting 911 calls from the Freedom of Information Act. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think the rewrite has been absolutely vital in allowing the public and the media access to information that it really never had before. So since we put the Public Access Counselor in place and since it was made a statutory position with binding opinion authority, we now are able routinely, without consternation, without lawsuits, to get copies of subpoenas, to get copies of autopsy reports, police reports, arrest reports, search warrants, and invoices for legal services. So a whole series of, I think, very important public information that previously was very difficult to extract from public bodies, even if it was, you know, clear in state law that that information should be made public. So I think that we've seen really great success on that front. And I can tell you that the Public Access Counselor's office is unbelievably busy. On average, we are receiving over 325 requests for review every single month, and that's up from 285 a month last year. I think we handle anywhere between 30 and 50 hotline calls every single day where people are either trying to access information or make sure that the Open Meetings Act is followed. So I think that the Public Access Counselor's office has so far issued over 55 binding opinions, and so we're getting a lot more clarity in terms of the law and what needs to be followed. And what was the second part of your question?
If 911 calls should be subject to or exempt from FOIA.
Yeah, I mean, they have been released, and I think that they probably should be released.
And then further, Illinois right now is in a bit of limbo. We don't have an eavesdropping law after a court declared the law unconstitutional. Any beliefs in how Illinois should go forward? Is it as is and a free-for-all okay, or what limitations should Illinois have in terms of recording conversations like this one?
Well, the legislature is going to be making a determination about what they should put in the law and what will pass, and so I presume that we'll see some activity on that in the spring session. Quite frankly, I'm surprised we didn't see some of it in the session that ended earlier in the year.
Just looking back at the governor's race, there was so much talk about your potentially getting in it. Do you have any thoughts in terms of just the negative nature of this campaign, any regrets for not putting your name in at this point, or just thoughts on how that all went down?
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to serve as the Attorney General for the people of the state. Being able to be an advocate for the people and enforce the civil laws that we've got to protect people, whether it's the Consumer Fraud Act or the Public Utilities Act or our environmental laws, very satisfying. And I look forward to doing that in the future. And so, no, I have no regrets.
And then lastly, are you reading any interesting books, or have you lately? Or perhaps any interesting books with your children? I don't know. Maybe they're kids.
I read a lot of books with my children these days. I have a fourth grader and a first grader. So the first grader, we're reading some pretty basic books. The fourth grader is reading all the Rick Riordan books at this point. And although I have to say I haven't been reading those, I've read some of the John Green novels. That seemed pretty interesting. Although I did read Wonder, and she is reading that in school right now, so we've been reading that together, which is a pretty good book. So you're right. At this point, a lot of the reading I do, if it's not for work, it's helping with homework.
Well, thank you so much, Attorney General Lisa Madigan.
You're welcome.